From a quarantine studio brought to you by KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Mexico has finally declared a national emergency over the coronavirus pandemic, after the World Health Organization said that confirmed cases of infection surpassed 1,000. Still, the country has far fewer confirmed cases than the United States and has only recently begun implementing social distancing measures, advising people to limit contact with one another. Mexico's President Andrés Manuel López Obrador, as of mid-March, was ignoring the dangers of the COVID-19 virus, saying instead that he would rely on good luck charms to keep himself safe. He's also come under intense criticism for ignoring his own government's recommendations this past Saturday and traveling to Sinaloa to meet with the mother of the notorious drug lord El Chapo. My guest is Laura Carlson. She's the director of the Americas Program and a columnist for Foreign Policy in Focus. She is a journalist and TV host in the U.S. and Mexico. Joining us right now from Mexico, welcome to the program, Laura.
Thank you, Sonali.
So first, explain the evolution of AMLO, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, on this issue of the coronavirus. As I mentioned, in mid-March, he was, you know, sort of dismissing the dangers of this disease. Now he, too, like many heads of state around the world, most heads of state, has begun, you know, getting behind the need for social distancing.
Yeah. Well, so Nelly, I think there's actually a misconception there regarding the attitude of López Obrador, and especially if you take into account the attitude of the Mexican government in general. Beginning in January, they identified the risks of the coronavirus, and they began to organize, in some ways anyway, to prepare for the virus arriving in Mexico. The difference is their strategy. It's not so much that they underestimated the impact. They've always known that the impact is going to be intense in Mexico and that it's going to have an extremely high cost. But the difference in the strategy has to do with the fact that Mexico is a poor country. There are 52 million people who live in poverty, and there's a lot more who are kind of teetering on the edge. So what they were doing is measuring the cost of shutting down the economy for millions of people who live day to day. They can't live on savings. They can't live if they don't go out. Over half the economy is informal economy, people selling in the street. The costs of that economic shutdown with patterns and models for controlling the virus. Now, this is not 100% a defense of what the Mexican government has done, and we won't know if their strategy and especially their timing of when they called for the shutdown was correct or not until a couple weeks have gone by and we begin to see the peak of this. It also has to do with the fact that Mexico is kind of behind the curve. They are behind the curve of certainly Europe and also of the United States. When we look at the actions of the president himself, they're absurd. There's no justification for the trivial way of speaking about the virus on many occasions, for some of the things that you mentioned, using amulets instead of science at a certain point. But he was trying to give a message, let's just keep going until we have to shut down, because what this means in economic terms could actually end up killing as many or more people as the virus itself.
On our program earlier in the week, we had covered how the impact of the virus was impacting India, the second most populous nation in the world, and also, of course, one of the poorest. And there, poor Indians were having to choose between starvation or getting the disease. And I imagine that is a very similar choice facing poor nations in general. What's interesting is in Mexico, there have been cases of actually wealthy Mexicans contracting the disease first, because they're the ones that are doing a lot of traveling. In fact, I saw two stories. One was of a group of college students from Austin, Texas, going to Cabo San Lucas for spring break and coming back with the disease, but then also skiers from wealthy Mexican families going to Vail, Colorado, and getting coming back from the United States and becoming infected. So those people who are traveling long distances seem to be the ones who are spreading the infections, but the poorest seem to be the ones who will likely bear the worst burden of it.
Right. That's the difference between the physiological impact, which affects indiscriminately all classes, with depending on these kinds of sociological factors, with actually the higher rate of people who were traveling, and the economic impact, which will be seen a little bit more down the road. In the case of the wealthier people, that's also the difference between what Mexico has been measuring very carefully, the Mexican government, which is the transition from stage one to stage two. Stage one was imported cases, that they could basically track almost all the cases to a point of contagion outside the country. Then they waited quite a long time to put Mexico into stage two, which is when you have community transmission. And that was when finally the stay-at-home orders, which are still voluntary, they're not mandatory as in many other countries, but the stay-at-home orders and the emphatic messages to maintain a safe distance and to reduce all non-essential travel came down.
I understand that Mexico does have quite a bit of experience regarding infectious diseases. In 2009, the swine flu pandemic hit Mexico hard, and that a lot of the direction that the country is taking to tackle the coronavirus is based on its own modeling of how diseases have spread in the past. However, of course, this is a new disease. Still, a lot is still unknown, and there is fear that Mexico could go down the path that, say, Italy has gone down, right?
Yeah, there's a lot of fear and there's a lot of uncertainty about whether the measures will work. They are looking at the swine flu because Mexico was the epicenter of the swine flu. And I remember the vacant streets, people, the very few people who went out wearing masks. There was a very drastic response to the swine flu epidemic in Mexico. I think part of the reading of that is that we have to take as careful and kind of a surgical look as possible at this epidemic, how it travels, and how we need to limit it in order to, again, make the trade-off between the economic costs and the cost in human lives that could happen here. What they're trying to do, too, is flatten the curve, which everybody talks about. And in the case of Mexico, and again, this is the big problem with poor countries, they're trying to figure out how they can make it so that there isn't a peak period that completely saturates the health system. And that's another reason why they waited, and they're trying to build up the health system, of course. Everybody's looking for ventilators in poor countries. It's even harder to get a hold of them. And they're hoping that they can somehow, you know, both reduce it through no contact and spread it out a little bit so that the health system doesn't just collapse.
Now, one of the issues is testing. How far along is Mexico on testing? Some are suggesting that the numbers so far look lower than in the U.S. because there hasn't been as widespread testing. The Washington Post reports that the country has so far conducted about 65 tests per million inhabitants. In the U.S., where testing has also been low, it's 2,250 tests per million people. And there is a fear that the virus may be spreading unchecked, right?
Definitely. We can't rely on that number of how many people have, how many confirmed cases there are of coronavirus in Mexico because of the low level of testing. Again, the low level of testing is a choice, although it's also a reflection of the lack of access to tests, both for reasons of resources and reasons of availability. Essentially, what they've decided is that only people get tested if they're in the most vulnerable groups, if they have a known contact, and a couple of other very, very strict criteria. So many people who most definitely appear anyway to have coronavirus will not be tested. They'll be told to go home. There's a special number. In fact, there's a whole special way of processing people who almost definitely have coronavirus but will never be tested and hopefully won't have to be hospitalized. And that's a number. Then they actually bring a medical kit to your house that's delivered. They make sure that you have what you need to get the care to bring you through the disease. And so there's a lot of faith being put on the fact that people who aren't in these vulnerable groups will get it, but they won't die from it.
What is Mexico planning in terms of economic assistance to those who need it the most? So far, what I understand is that President López Obrador has urged companies to keep people on payrolls and to, you know, not lay them off. But is there any action in the works in terms of legislation, direct economic assistance, etc.?
Yes, there is action. There's going to be a major announcement on Sunday that gives a fuller picture of what the economic package looks like to, again, keep the most vulnerable from falling through the cracks when the economic impact is most widely felt. So far, we've seen an increase in producer prices for agricultural producers as a concern that food production continue. There's also been a major fund created for small and medium enterprises. And what the president has said is that the big companies will not be bailed out. There's a clear focus to the poor and the most vulnerable in this. The pensions for the elderly have already been doubled, but there's still enormous gaps. Civil society is trying to see what kinds of mechanisms they can come up with to help the people. Domestic workers, sex workers, women are particularly vulnerable because they have the dual problem of many of them working in an informal economy, where they're most vulnerable, where they have no benefits, where they don't even have regular salaries. If they don't go out and work, they don't have any income. And at the same time, being required in their homes to take care of kids who are out of school for over a month, to take care of the elderly, to take care of people who are getting sick, and this tremendous workload without any additional support. So we'll see how that economic package looks on Sunday. It's most likely to be insufficient. It's most likely to continue to have major gaps, especially where it concerns lack of a gender perspective. But we'll have to analyze that when it comes out.
So what about the Central American migrants and refugees that have been forced to remain in Mexico as their cases are being processed in the United States, the asylum seekers? The Trump administration in the United States has repeatedly pushed to keep this policy in place, and the Supreme Court has affirmed it. This, I imagine, is an incredibly vulnerable population in Mexico. They were already vulnerable before the coronavirus, and like refugee populations around the world, they are likely falling to the bottom of the priority list for governments, right?
Absolutely, Sonali. It's a real tragedy what's happening on both borders in Mexico, because Mexico, again, is being squeezed from both sides. On the southern border, where there's concentration of Central American refugees, in fact, people are being sent back there from other parts of the country. On March 31st, there was a riot at a detention center, and a Guatemalan was killed after a fire was started because the people in the detention center were so concerned about the fact that they were basically sitting ducks for the coronavirus. They were in overcrowded, unhygienic situations. We've heard about this as well in detention centers in the United States. In Mexico, it's probably worse. And Central Americans are pleading to just go back to their countries. But then you have, as you mentioned, the fact that Central American countries have closed their borders, that nobody's working to get them back there, to get them to any place that's even slightly safe. So the pressures are building up, the risks are building up, and the possibility that there are going to be severe outbreaks of coronavirus, both within those detention centers on the southern border of people who really, at this point, most of whom just want to go back home, many of whom actually can't go back home because they're refugees who are fleeing life-threatening conditions, you know, and then also on the northern border, On the northern border, what we see is that there have been large camps of asylum seekers who are seeking asylum in the United States, some of them up to 2,000 and more people who've been camped along there waiting for their hearings in the United States. So what does the United States government do in this crisis in which these people, these families are particularly vulnerable? First of all, it cancels all their hearings. They can no longer expect to even have a hearing and continue what has been their extremely dangerous and difficult journey to try to seek safety in the United States. They're being canceled until sometime in May. Then they begin sending back everyone who attempts to seek asylum in the United States to Mexico, and the Mexican government has agreed to receive them. Not just Mexicans who are apprehended at the border at either authorized or unauthorized ports of entry, but also Central Americans. So we're seeing this population, this at-risk population, actually grow during this time. Now, there's some reports that the Mexican government is breaking up those camps and sending people off, but nobody really knows where they're sending them to. And especially in the context that Guatemala is refusing to take back any deportees, especially from the United States, because the United States is now the epicenter of coronavirus in the region of the Americas. So if even before this crisis, this health crisis, it was clear that refugees and migrants were the unwanted everywhere and being batted about as if they weren't even human beings, it's even more clear and it's even more high risk right now with the situation that we're seeing with the outbreak of the virus.
Do you have any sense that anybody is doing any sort of testing? It's possible that there are already cases of infection in that population, especially near the northern border, but we just may not know.
Well, there are non-governmental organizations that are working that are trying to keep tabs on the situation and report, and I'm not sure how much access to tests they actually have with the cooperation of the state governments, but they are looking for people who show symptoms. Now, again, the problem is if you're running a shelter or a refugee camp, essentially, what happens when you find somebody with symptoms? Where are you going to take that person to isolate them? There's no space. Right. There's no facilities for that. So even if you knew, and even when they know, they're not sure at all what they're going to do about it.
Laura, I want to go back to what you were saying earlier about the way in which women in general are disproportionately impacted. This is not just something that, of course, applies to refugee populations or even just to Mexico. It applies here in the United States as well. We do see a gendered aspect to this crisis, as we do to so many crises. One of the things that has come out is the fear that incidents of domestic violence increase when there are shelter-at-home orders. But in general, the bulk of the work also falls to women as well, right?
Those are the two problems, yeah. And the Mexican government has indicated there was a special conference on the issue of women during the coronavirus crisis, that it is aware of both these problems, particularly the problem of increased violence, because it's well documented that this is a risk, and not only a risk, but this has happened in the past in similar situations. However, the measures that they've put forward to deal with it are weak and completely insufficient. Essentially, they are publicizing 911 so that women can call emergency numbers if they're in situations of risk. And there have been no funds put forth whatsoever to directly assist women caregivers in the household. At the same time, women caregivers in the society, 90% of around 2.4 million domestic workers who have essentially no guaranteed rights. They either lose their jobs or they're forced to continue to carry out their jobs in more difficult situations, in risky situations. Or they're just left completely on their own. The sex workers, caregivers for the elderly in the paid economy as well as the unpaid economy. There doesn't seem to be a coherent plan for any of these people. And in fairness, we haven't seen that kind of a coherent plan with a real gender perspective in other countries as well. Unfortunately, the pensions or the support that has been at times given to single parents, single women parents, was not included in a constitutional reform that would make that mandatory. And now they only receive special support if they're carrying out their education, which now is impossible for everyone. So it's a serious situation. They're looking to see what happens and trying to be aware of it. But again, most of, for example, the judicial system is no longer working. You know, they're no longer required to go to offices, so women may not have anywhere to go to report a crime. The system of shelters for women has been defunded by the government and is urgently looking for money, and yet they don't have what they need to accept the women that they currently have, let alone a spike in domestic violence. Mm.
So, Laura, what advice would you give the president, just as a journalist who's been observing all of the places where the country, where Mexico is vulnerable to this crisis? What would you like to see happen in the country? Like in the U.S., I imagine in Mexico, one has to really fight to see the poor represented, even though President López Obrador is, you know, considered left of center, campaigned on being pro-poor. There, of course, is always pressure required to remind governments that poor people, vulnerable people, women matter.
Yeah, that's right. I think what has to be done is, first of all, they've got to clean up their game in terms of communication. The president is now serious about talking about the need for social distancing, but he's continuing his tours. He's continuing with a number of actions that send out the message that of do as I do, not as I say.
So he's just traveling around the country?
Every weekend. Hmm. Every weekend. He's going to supervise, you know, public works and this kind of thing. And the justification is my enemies want to see a vacuum in the presidency. I'm going to show them there. But he could do that without violating the health rules that the rest of the population has to follow. So the whole communication and personal example and leadership in that sense has to be much more coherent. The other is that while there's a lot of discourse about this emphasis on the poor and even some about the emphasis on women, there have to be very, very specific and targeted programs that recognize the work of women in the home as caregivers and that compensate that for them for the work that they're doing with an economic support directly to the women themselves, to the people who are doing that care work. And then there has to be one thing that's been positive about this is the transparency. There's these press conferences consistently, and yet there's still areas in which it's not clear what's happening. And that, of course, raises the specter that it's really not clear within the government what's happening either. One of the other areas of concern is that there's been a huge amount of resources. We're 4 billion pesos to the military to run hospitals, to confront the virus, to the military and to the National Guard. And so the question is, why not use that money to create, to build up the civilian healthcare system in such a way that it can get itself and get the rest of us through this crisis and come out of it with a much stronger public healthcare system, which Mexico needs, which all countries need. This should be the lesson for everyone. And it's not clear that's what we're seeing. We're seeing kind of stopgap measures at this point. And then again, this somewhat, to me, inexplicable emphasis on the role of the armed forces.
Well, Laura, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate your time. Best of luck to you.
Thank you. You too, Sonali. Take care.
My guest has been Laura Carlson. She's director of the Americas Program and also columnist for Foreign Policy in Focus. She's a journalist and TV host in the United States and Mexico, joining us from Mexico to talk about how that nation has been dealing with the spread of coronavirus. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.